I'm Abby Kinney, and you are listening to Upzoned. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to another episode of Upzoned, where we take a story each week from the news that touches the Strong Towns conversation, and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. I'm Abby Kinney with Gould Evans. This week, I'm joined once again by our regular co-host, Chuck Marone, and we've got a really interesting piece to discuss that is incredibly relevant to your work, Chuck, but also to those of us just seeking to understand how this pandemic can lead to innovative thinking of current systems. So I'm excited to talk through this one with you.
Oh, yeah. Actually, when I first read this piece, I'm like, oh, I love this topic. So, City Observatory, Joe Courtwright. This is a fun one.
This article is called "What COVID-19 Teaches Us About How to Fix Freeways." Joe basically describes a phenomenon on Portland's typically congested I-5 freeway, where it now carries more cars faster at peak hours than it did prior to the pandemic. Although daily traffic volumes have gone down overall, peak hours are actually seeing higher volumes of traffic moving at double the normal speed. He attributes this odd manifestation to today's lack of what he calls traffic saturation, saying that now that demand is throughout the peak hours is more managed, freeways aren't reaching the tipping point or the point at which the road gets overloaded and cars start to slow down. The author concludes that limiting demand actually makes freeways work better. And in a post-COVID-19 world, we ought to be focusing on managing demand rather than expansion, especially as state departments of transportation are going to be seeing continued budget shortfalls. So this experiment really shows us that there may be ways to fight congestion in more cost-effective ways than, say, expanding the physical capacity of freeways. Moving forward, I think it's going to be really critical that we rethink these conventional approaches to dealing with congestion and assess the trade-offs associated with reducing it.
There's so many different aspects of this that I think are fascinating. The first one is just this realization that we're actually during peak periods of time handling more vehicles now than we were before. Even though there are fewer vehicles on the road, like during the peak period, more traffic is being handled by the current system. And it's just because you're not sitting stuck in congestion. What that tells you is that if we can somehow keep vehicles from reaching that point, we can actually move more people in less time, which isn't that the goal? It's kind of strange because you're like, what's the goal of the transportation system? And it should be to move people in the least amount of time when you're talking about highways over distance.
So this article has actually made me think about that. It's made me wonder about what the true advantages of highways are in the first place. And there's certainly a lot of benefits that our interstate highway system brings us, especially from a commercial and industrial perspective. They play an important role in lifting communities up and supporting job creation and potentially producing the kind of productivity that makes this massive investment in infrastructure worthwhile. The author mentions that one of the reasons we have these frequent traffic jams is because there's just nothing to stop too many cars from entering a freeway all at once, causing it to become congested once it hits the tipping point. So he explains that a lot of perceived improvements, like adding entrance ramps or expanding capacity, can actually cause jams sooner because they are making it so easy to enter the highway. So if redundancy of highway ramps is something that is causing congestion, why would our first impulse be to spend enormous amounts of money expanding the capacity of freeways rather than maybe limit the use of ramps for civilian use, maybe just limiting for freight or transportation or transit?
Right. Because highway investments are not about moving vehicles. I mean, moving vehicles is the conversation we use to talk about it, but it's actually about all those economic growth metrics. The idea that if we pump money into transportation, out the other end comes jobs, growth, and economic development. That has been long established as dogma. It's not true, but it is true in like a very simplistic way. And so what you see is oftentimes, despite the negative impacts that this stuff has on actually moving people and goods at speed over distance, we opt for the thing that provides that short-term financial gain. If you look at traffic flow, it's fascinating. I remember back just as an undergrad, and you'd study this because these models have been long known. I mean, Joe refers in his piece to, you know, secrets that traffic engineers know that you don't. And this is one of them. When you have traffic flowing, and if you continue to add vehicles, 1, 2, 3, 4, you'll reach this point where the speed starts to degrade a little bit. Things start to slow down. But then you reach this magic point where the speed actually goes back up again. And it goes up because there's so many drivers there, there's so many vehicles there that you can no longer switch lanes. And so you can think about it as like turbulence, like, you know, just friction. When people switch lanes, people are slowing down, and that reflects back like a slinky back through the system. When you reach this point of like this super saturation where you can't really add any more vehicles, but you can't also like move and switch lanes, speeds actually go up and you reach this kind of like nirvana point where you've got the max amount of cars working in concert with each other at very, very high speeds. But you add one more car to the mix and speeds drop to like nothing. You become instantly congested and it goes way down. And you reach this point where like nobody's moving at all and all of your capacity is wasted. And so from a design standpoint, if we're just like numbers geeks, right? Like we don't care about anything else. We're just optimizing the amount of traffic. There are these theories or models that you can set up that say, if we could just limit traffic, if we just set this up a certain way, we could actually move the maximum amount of cars at one time in one place. And that number just happens to be like way, way, way more than what we're moving now today with our current system.
Yeah, that's really interesting. But the other problem with focusing on highway expansion and the purpose of just moving cars throughout a region is that it enables land use patterns to spread out and further creates the type of city where people need to commute long distances and are super reliant on a personal car. Freeway congestion is, in a sense, an outcome of building that type of city. At the end of the day, is it really the government's role to eliminate minor inconveniences caused by what is essentially an issue of land use? We never sat down and decided that enabling commuters not to experience congestion is a reasonable justification for the enormous price of highway expansion. If infrastructure costs are so unmanageable, then we ought to explore alternatives to expansion and definitely not pursue expansion that is unproductive to us. Government entities across the country were already struggling before the coronavirus pandemic, and economic shutdowns are likely to create major budget gaps. At this point, I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily an advocate for austerity, but we'd have to be completely out of touch with reality to be expanding freeways with little real long-term return on investment. I feel like the issue of congestion gets money thrown at it without many people blinking an eye. So I kind of ask us all this, is congestion really that much of an inconvenience or that big of a social ill? And what about the people who experience inconveniences biking or walking on local streets for their commutes? What about using that money just to make our public spaces safer? At this point, we have so many other options that are less expensive and less invasive than freeway expansion. These options are relatively small bets. So before approving these $200 million expansions or reconstruction projects, why don't we just try something different? And better yet, make sure that local governments actually get a fair share of federal and state budgets based on maybe hitting performance goals of multimodal local transportation. Let's reward good behavior and use funds to build balanced networks.
Right. I think that is correct. I think there's a couple of interesting things that are offshoots of that because, I mean, obviously we have this system right now and it's a disaster. It's a mess. It massively underperforms. And I think what we're seeing now and what Joe Courtright points out in his article is that like, look, now that we're having this experiment foisted upon us and we're able to model this in a way we couldn't 2 months ago, look at what's happening. Like this is really revealing something to us. Do you guys have the ramp meters there in Kansas City?
I've seen them in a couple of places where it asks you to stop and then it waits, you know, a few seconds before turning green, but I haven't seen it in many places. It's definitely not the norm, but it does seem to work.
So we have them pretty ubiquitous here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area down in the Twin Cities. It's interesting because the ramp meters, the way they're supposed to work, and this is the technocrat approach to managing traffic. The idea of the ramp meters is that if we can keep that one car that pushes you over the edge to congestion, if we can keep that car off the freeway, we can actually reach this point where we will move the optimum amount of traffic in the least amount of time. The interesting thing, I was a grad student when they did this experiment, because the ramp meters have always been controversial. And the funny thing is that if you go out into the suburbs and in the exurbs, what winds up happening is you sit at the ramp meter and you look out at the freeway and the freeway is not congested. And so your gut reaction is like, I'm wasting my time. And then as you get closer in to the center of the city, you sit in a long line at the ramp meter. And then when you get on the highway, it's completely congested. You don't go anywhere. And so the pushback was from the suburban legislators, like, these are a waste of our time. They're costing us long commutes. They're terrible. So they actually did this thing where they, for 2 weeks, I think it was 2 weeks, it was like the worst 2 weeks of my life when I was in graduate school, they shut off the ramp meters. So I lived in Elk River, which is a exurb of Minneapolis-St. Paul. It was halfway between Minneapolis and St. Cloud, and my wife worked in St. Cloud, and I was going to school. So that's where we moved for that two-year period of time that I was in grad school. And they shut off the ramp meters. And here's what happened. Everybody who was close to the university got to school more quickly than they otherwise did. Everybody who was like in a first ring suburb, nothing really changed all that much for them. Their travel time was about the same. The further you went out, the longer your commute became, to the point where mine went from being 45 minutes to over 2.5 hours. The reason is the ramp meters had made it so efficient for cars to be able to travel on the road. It actually privileged people who had long commutes. It privileged the road for them at the expense of people who had short commutes. And so what would happen on a normal day with the ramp meters is that people who live very close would have to sit and wait and wait and wait and wait, and then they'd finally be allowed to meter on. People who live far away got to get on relatively quickly and created all the congestion. When you turned off the ramp meters, what happened is that everybody who lived close to the city center got to get where they needed to go. And once they were there, that essentially cleared out the congestion, and then the first ring suburbs could come in. And as soon as they cleared out and got to where they wanted to go, the second ring suburbs, and then on and on and on. So there's this perversity to what Joe is suggesting here that's very interesting, because he is absolutely right. We can run a lot more cars through this system in a shorter period of time if we manage the flow better. Where that has been done, and I would point to Minneapolis and St. Paul as a prime example, what that has resulted in is more demand for the most exurban of living. Because you actually shift the privilege of being able to use the system from the people who are close into their destination to the people who are very far away. And I think that that's one of these like weird outcomes that you get when you actually techno-manage a system as opposed to have like the market respond to it.
And that's something that I was actually thinking about in terms of congestion pricing, which is the other solution that is brought up in this article. For listeners who are not aware of what congestion pricing is, it basically means enacting tolls that vary based on the time of day, so that at peak hours, the cost would go up when the demand is greater. Congestion pricing definitely seems interesting to me because Kansas City is designed under a parks and boulevard system, meaning that we actually have several quasi-freeways that run through our city and are actually maintained by the local government. These are the main routes that people are using who live closer in. The freeways are better served for people who live further out. I wonder if congestion pricing might actually put more stress on the already crumbling local infrastructure that we have. And if so, how would you divert funds to support that? I don't know what the implications of this is in Portland or in other places, but because Kansas City's local street network layout, our freeways really don't speed up commute times to, say, downtown unless you are pretty far out. They actually don't seem to contribute much to the day-to-day life of people living in the pre-1950s city limits. So it seems that establishing maybe user fees that are more equitable funding approaches would more directly relate to the cost of driving. I wonder if something as simple as an odometer on your car can be the measurement for judging how much you pay for the use of using streets. I'm not really sure what the solution is.
Here's how I would approach it. And I wrote this book about a while ago now called The World-Class Transportation System. It's just like a Kindle ebook. I don't even know if you can still get it. I might have taken it down. But one of the concepts I explored in there was this idea of shifting to an access tax. So if you look at a highway, the value that a highway provides is that it allows you to move goods and people, materials and people over long distances very quickly. Anything that degrades that capacity, so an interchange, an on-ramp, anything that degrades the capacity of you moving quickly, as you know, is described in this article that Joe put together, is a net negative. If you look at then the street network, like once you get off the interstate and you're on a street, the idea of a street is not to move vehicles quickly. It's to build wealth, build value. It's to create a place. And so to me, like the answer to your question is, I think cities need to be talking about building places. Like the place has to have a lot of wealth, and that's how you pay for the street. That's how you pay for the infrastructure, not by taxing the vehicles. But once you get on the highway, then some type of mileage tax or some type of usage fee makes sense. And I think that the linchpin of this would actually be something like an access tax. Right now, if you want to build a Walmart on a highway, and let's go to a rural area, because in the rural areas, there's like less friction to doing this. If you want to build a Walmart on a highway in a rural area, you just buy the land and put the building down and then apply for an access permit. And you might have to spend $100,000, $200,000 building a turn lane or what have you. But basically, the public will absorb that infrastructure cost, and you will be able to access, or as I call it, mine, the value of that highway for your own private gain for your Walmart or your big box store, or your gas station, or whatever it is. The problem is that creates the conflict point, the source of the conflict of slowing down the traffic. Now you have an intersection. Now you have traffic coming in and merging and switching lanes and slowing things down. To me, that's where the tax should be assessed. And I would actually assess it on the community or the land value. So if you want to put the Walmart there, that's fine. The Walmart's going to have not much value if there's not much traffic. If there's a lot of traffic, it's going to have a lot of value. Well, if there's a lot of traffic, the tax to interfere with that traffic should be really, really high. Like really high. I think I calculated once, I think for that ebook I went through and I'm like, for a location like this one, and I pointed out a place where there was, 40,000, 50,000 cars a day, it should be like $500,000 a year access tax for that building, because that's the damage you're creating, the cost you're having on society by actually building this interchange here, the access. We don't think of it that way because as local governments, we want the highway with the interchange because then we get growth. The highway department wants the highway because they want to move traffic. Those two things are actually at odds with each other. And because of the way our political system distributes these dollars, and because of the fact that the money for the DOT is given by politicians who want the growth, what it's done is it's made the DOTs more sensitive to the demand for growth than for actually building a good transportation system that moves people.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, not everybody who runs for public office understands that not all growth is necessarily good growth, especially in the long term. You know, I think there's also something to be said on the commuting side about telecommuting and even living locally. We're seeing that telecommuting is a feasible option for many businesses nowadays, and perhaps now is the time to call on the private sector to enable workers to work part-time from home if possible. I know that a lot of companies in Kansas City already do this, and empowering flexibility can help reduce the perceived need to overspend on freeways. I actually was discussing this article with a friend of mine who is a traffic planner, Drew Pearson, and he was suggesting that perhaps companies or teams could even identify like core availability times to satisfy the need of communication consistency while also bypassing the need for strict 9-to-5 work times.
This is something that, you know, at Strungtowns, I've written about a number of times. The only response to congestion that will work to actually make things better over the long term is to replace the demand for long range trips with demand for short range trips. If we can make it so that you don't have to drive multiple miles to get basic things, to get your job, to get to a doctor, to get to the grocery store, but we can make those things that you have the option to bike, you have the option to walk, you have the option to take localized transit. Those things are actually things that reduce demand for those peak periods of time. And what happens is that the congestion becomes the feedback loop that creates the development. So in other words, if we look at someone who needs to get out to get groceries, and we say, you can't go at 8 or 9 a.m. because, you know, the road's too busy, but you can go at 10. Okay, they can switch around their daytime. But if we look and we say, okay, things are too busy at 8 and 9, so let's add more capacity, let's build more highway lanes, let's put a couple hundred million into a new interchange, a new act. If we respond that way, then what happens is you don't get that shifting at all. And I think we get that. I think we understand that. Like the person going to get groceries can just as easily go at 10 as they can at 7 a.m., but the person at 7 a.m. needs to get to a job that starts at 8. If we take that logic and we express it the next way, what we see is that we can actually create demand for local neighborhoods. Because if you can't go at 8 to get milk or 9 to get milk or 10 or 11 without sitting in a lot of traffic, you now have a demand for something else. Give me an alternative. Build that thing that I can just walk to. Build that thing that's close to me. And when cities don't allow that, when they don't allow their neighborhoods to thicken up, when they don't allow places to respond, when they don't allow mixed use to start to evolve, they take away that option. The way we solve congestion is to bring that option back and to allow people to respond to it, not just by building big things and not just by shifting the time they start work or the time they go out to do something, but by actually shifting the way we build and respond to those demands on the ground. And that'll actually make us wealthier.
Maybe the current situation will be an opportunity for us to rethink all these different systems and just how we're living day-to-day life as a society. There may be opportunities there if we're willing to confront them. I think that this is a good time to end here. But before we end, we're going to move into the down zone, which is the part of this show where we can share anything that we've been listening to, reading, watching, or just fun activities we've been doing. Chuck, do you have anything that you'd like to share this week?
Let me share a happy one, and then I'll tell you the book I'm reading, which is not as happy. This weekend, we're now ready to plant in the Marone garden out at the Marone homestead. And so we're putting in potatoes and corn. So I'm actually going to go do that. Ground is warmed up enough and I got my fence now ready to go up. So yeah, we're been working hard out there and I'm ready to go. I've been reading Jane Jacobs' Dark Age Ahead, and it's a book that I wanted to go back and read now because I enjoyed it when it came out. I've read it a second time, and every time you read it, you realize just how deeply insightful Jane Jacobs was. Obviously, we all know that, but I think a lot of us know it in terms of like her perception on urban form. And I really think that her deepest perceptions have always been about just human systems and how they tend to, you know, to thwart our best intentions over time. And so Dark Age Ahead is really, you know, she didn't predict a pandemic, but she certainly predicted a lot of the fragility that we see impacting us so deeply now. So yeah, I would recommend that if anybody's looking for a deeper understanding of what's going on right now.
That's actually one of her books that I have not had a chance to read. So I might have to add that to my list.
It makes me a little sad. And I'll say it like this. I didn't know Jane Jacobs. Like I know there are people that I know who knew her personally and they, you know, speak highly of her and how wonderful a person she was. It's hard to read that book and not think of someone near the end of her life than the beginning, clearly, who was frustrated with the fact that so much like stupidity remains in a world when, you know, like the answers are so clear, you know, like why do humans do this? And there's a certain sadness that I get in thinking about the frustration that she must have felt at times with just like people. I've been writing this for 50 years, like, and you all say like, you love my work and you want to do this. And then you turn around and you do the opposite. Like what do I have to do? And so there's a certain like melancholiness I get when I read that book, because I think of her personally and some of the frustration she must have had when she put that book together, because I she had to have known that she was not going to be around a lot longer. I mean, she was elderly at this point. So I don't know. It makes me a little melancholy when I read it, not just because of the subject, but just because of her as a person.
Yeah, that actually reminds me of a quote by George Carlin. Inside every cynical person is a disappointed idealist. And I think a lot of people,
yeah.
I think a lot of people share that kind of frustration because, you know, especially people who are motivated and excited to make change, and you realize that there's these systems that don't motivate good behavior, and it is frustrating. And I'm sure that there's tons of people who share that frustration. I'm reading a book that is making me sad too right now. I'm reading a book by Richard Rothstein called The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. I'm sure that you are aware of the book and many of our listeners may be aware of it. It's a lot of information that I had learned in planning school. And I remember when I was learning it, it's obviously frustrating to hear. But it's also frustrating in a sense because many of our public school systems don't teach this information, and it's information that I think is integral to how our society functions, and it's relevant to just about every American city. So that was kind of one of the first things that I thought when I was first learning about or de jure segregation and the housing policies that have been enacted by our government at all these different scales. The fact that the public school system that I went to, which, by the way, in St. Louis, was a pretty good public school system. It was a good district, and they did not teach this. And I had to get all the way to college before learning this information that is so relevant to just day-to-day society and why things are the way they are. I think that does a real disservice to people in this country, especially because not everybody goes to college. So if you have to go to college and take some social science class to even learn this information, that's the real disappointment to me.
You and I have both seen the maps that Urban 3 put together on Kansas City's redlining. And, you know, how that has manifested over the decades. And I think the thing that is the most pernicious to me and sad, I think, is a good way to put the reaction to this is, you know, how culturally, I know here in my own hometown, you know, 2 decades ago, if you would have asked me, I would have said, well, that part of town over there where it's not thriving, that part of town, those people don't care about their places. They're not as vested as we are in this part of town. And there's a certain like narrative, and I'm describing this in my own way because I think this is a very human thing to do. But even today, to the extent that we have, you know, moved past the overt racism of the past, you still recognize that there are these legacy effects that are pernicious, that are just deeply embedded, that play out in just this myriad of ways that are part of our public consciousness, what I just described, like that neighborhood, the people there don't care, not recognizing that like that neighborhood was systematically disinvested in for decades because of top-down policy. It's a history that's important to know because it does help frame the way that we understand and perceive a lot of the struggles that we see today. And I'm just very thankful for that conversation and being able to be exposed to it.
It's an incredible book. And so anybody who hasn't read it, even if you already know the history of housing policy in the United States, I would highly recommend that you go get this book or listen to it on Audible. I'm actually listening to it right now. So
I know. I'm going to give you a tip now too. So I heard you listening when I logged in, you were listening to it and then you had to shut off so we could do this recording. You got to jack up the speed on that thing. You got to, I'm going to give you like the pro tip 101 here. This is pro audiobook tip 101. I listen to my books on 2 speed or 2.5 speed, but you know, if that's too much for you, and I know that's too much for some people, even if you just do like 1.4 or 1.5 speed, you find that the authors read at a very slow pace and your brain is capable of hearing and processing and remembering at much higher speeds. And you'll get used to it really quick. And it will actually like double the amount of books you can get through in the same amount of time. Cause I mean, you can like, when you listen at double speed, a 20-hour book is like 10 hours, you know?
We'll have to have an audiobook race sometime and then write an essay.
I worked my way up to where like I was doing triple speed. And even I said, like, that's too fast. Like, I can't retain enough at that speed. It's too much. But double speed, you know, is pretty manageable. You should give it a try.
Yeah, I'll give it a try, and I'll see if I'm processing the information. Because just like when you're reading a book, sometimes you're listening, and then you start thinking of other things, and you're like, "What was the last chapter about? I need to go back." Yeah. So, yeah. You know, it's just one of those things where you have to make sure that you're paying attention when it's on.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that concludes this episode. We didn't go too far over the time.
We're getting better.
We're getting better. We're trying. So thank you everybody for listening, and keep doing what you can to build a strong town. Let me show you what